Welcome to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randall. Dive into the live courtroom drama as we bring you unfiltered audio from one of the most riveting trials of the year. Accused of multiple marital murders, Randall's fate unfolds before us. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. This is Dark Vows.
Actually, he didn't empty the gun. The gun holds 8 rounds, and then you could have one in the chamber. He shot 5 times. So he didn't empty the gun, but he did say over and over again that he shot Mr. Miller in that hallway. The problem, of course, is that the ballistic evidence and the evidence of the walls and doors in that hallway don't reflect that. There's only one piece of ballistic evidence in that scene, in the hallway, and it's right at the base of the door of the door that would go from the inside of the house into the garage. There's that one cartridge case that's item number 3 that was collected by crime scene analysts. There's no dents on the walls. There's no other cartridge cases. There's no blood. There's no markings to indicate anything hit that wall where Mr. Miller was allegedly standing. All we have is that single piece of evidence, of ballistic evidence, and that's that casing, the one in at the base of the doorway. As you know from the testimony in the case, all of the other ballistic evidence, the bullets, the additional cartridge cases, those are all located in the garage. Now, we know on the 8th that the crime scene analyst did find a mark of a bullet strike on the wall to the south of that hallway, kind of towards the master bedroom area. There was that mark really high up on the wall, kind of above where the doorbell was. And they go up on those shelves and they find 2 pieces of like a fragmented bullet. But that, we know, isn't associated with Michael Miller, right? We know that that bullet is associated with Sharon Randolph in a couple ways. There's a close-up of those fragments. One, we know from the autopsy that the bullet that struck her head fragmented, right? So you can actually see the fragments on the x-ray there, and that bullet fragmented once it hit her skull. We also know that fragments of the bullet were recovered at the autopsy of Sharon Randolph. By contrast, an intact bullet was the only one that was recovered from Michael Miller. So it's evident that those items 12 and 13 that were on the shelves relate to Sharon Randolph's injury rather than Michael Miller's. Now, the defense throughout the trial has offered sort of theories of why it was that there was no ballistic evidence except for that one cartridge case in the hallway. And they are basically, hey, look, those cartridge cases bounced out the door as Randolph shot Miller. The cartridge cases moved because of the actions of first responders. The cleaning crew moved everything. And then the last sort of catch-all is, you know, you really can't expect Thomas Randolph to remember how this played out. So let's talk about the first theory, which is that the cartridge cases bounced out that door as Thomas Randolph shot Michael Miller. Here's the problem with that. In the first interview, Thomas Randolph describes the shots that he inflicted on Michael Miller when he's in the garage, and he says it's after that that he props the door with that rug.
And you fired... How many more times?
I think just once more, because once or twice maybe.
So he's describing, and you'll have all the interviews back in the deliberation room, the last 2 shots, 1 or 2 that he describes, that occurs in the garage, right? Those last ones when he goes out there. And what does he say he does after that?
You know, I slid the rug up under the door so the door would be open so I could see him, because I... still, you know, one of what's going on, I wasn't going to check on him, I wanted to check on Sharon.
So you go up and you check on Sharon.
I tried to roll her over, I tried to talk to her. I bent down, and that's when there was the gun was there, because I bent down on it, it was laying somewhere in that vicinity, and...
So after the shooting is all done, the defendant says he props the door with the rug, and then attends to Sharon. And that would have made it impossible for any of those cartridge cases or bullets or anything like that to have bounced through the door, because according to him, on the 9th, that door was shut until all the shooting was done, and he propped the door after to go keep an eye on Mr. Miller and go attend to Sharon Randolph. Now, to be fair, in the walkthrough a week later, the defendant adjusts his story a little bit and says that the door is open.
Yeah, and then he was headed toward the door. And that was it.
All right, so show me his movement from the time that he came up here, back here. Were you first seeing him? Show me what you saw him do. Back here. The door was closed, right?
No, the door would be open. I closed the door after they told me to go get the gun and close the door.
Well, this is before all that's happening, though, because you're still defending.
Right. And I had the door, when I came in and seen Sharon, I had the door. Yeah, I did. I stood here from this. Sharon called at her a couple of times, and I actually started, like I told you, I pushed the garage and then stopped it because I was actually going to go get the neighbors.
Think about what he's saying there. He comes in, he sees his wife collapsed on the floor. And his thought isn't to run to her, according to him. He doesn't know if she's had a medical episode. He hasn't seen anybody in the house at that point. He's saying, I walk in, I see her, and I decide to prop a door, maybe go see the neighbor. Does that make sense to you? And the other thing he says in that clip is that rug somehow stayed in place when Michael Miller went tumbling out it after the exchange in the hallway. Even if the door was open, consider all the obstacles that were in that garage. This is a crowded garage, and we know one of the cases ended up on the side of the Pontiac car. Here's an overall view of that garage, and another case ends up on the complete opposite side of that garage, and there's bullets on those sides as well. All of those things make it impossible for the cases or the bullets to fly out of the fly out of that garage door and then disperse in opposite directions. Let's move on to the second theory offered by the defense is, well, first responders moved all that ballistic evidence. You heard from first responders, you heard they're trained to not move around evidence to clear houses and try to avoid stepping on things. You also heard that they entered through the front door rather than the garage. They didn't go from the garage into the hallway. They went first to Mrs. Randolph, saw her in the hallway, and then backed out. Mr. Miller was treated in the garage by medical, but there was no testimony that any of them traversed from the garage back inside the house, and even if they did, that's sort of the wrong direction for the evidence to be moving. So that theory kind of leaves us with, again, one piece of ballistic evidence in that hallway and no marks on the wall. In addition, when the first responders came to the scene, they had yet another obstacle in Michael Miller. So it's not as though a casing landed on him. It's not as though there was a stray bullet that that made it to the sides and bounced off of him. There's only the evidence on the sides, on opposite sides of that garage, which is not consistent with what the defendant described. So let's talk about the cleaning crew. This was another theory that the cleaning crew, they must have cleaned up all this stuff. So we know on the 8th that there was that strike up high on the wall, and they collect that evidence on the 8th into the 9th. And they see nothing else in that hallway to photograph, to collect, no defects in the wall, no evidence of any strikes on that hallway portion where Mr. Randolph says he's shooting Mr. Miller. But we know when the detectives go back on the 15th, it's not as though that cleaning crew patched up that wall. That's still there. And this probably isn't the best advertisement for the cleaning crew because there's all kinds of other evidence left behind indicating that cleaning crew didn't really clean the place up that much. There's they also find two other cases in the garage. This is the original photo on the night of the 8th. We know that there is a cartridge case sort of where that light bulb is in that toolbox, and then a little bit beyond that, there's another cartridge case. So we know that those last two cartridge cases end up in the garage as well as a result of the shooting. The only other explanation for that is that the cleaning crew somehow found them and deposited them into those two areas. This is the photograph of the 15th, and it's barely moved. So you'll have to make a determination if the cartridge cases happened to be there the whole time and they just missed them on the first go through on the 8th, or if the cleaning crew somehow took it upon themselves to put them in those locations and just leave. Here's closer pictures of where they are. They're right by that water bottle tucked in the back and also in that kind of cluttered toolbox. So we're left with the same evidence we started with. All of the ballistic evidence is in the garage area, except for that one cartridge case at the base of the door. So the next theory offered by the defense is, you know, it's just really too hard to remember how this happened. The problem with that is Thomas Randolph claims to remember. He describes this over and over again in the same exact way with a few minor changes, and he always describes the shooting occurring in the hallway. This time, when you see his descriptions, I'd ask you to please take note of which direction, which side of Mr. Miller's body he is explaining is exposed to him when he's firing the shots.
As we got up in here, he kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him, boom, boom, boom. He started going out toward the shed. I don't know how many times they shot him, but I just kept right on going. Boom, boom, boom. And he's just laying there. Just laying there.
Where was he in relation to you when you fired the first time?
Maybe right there.
So he's, now is he going?
No, he's turned toward me still. He's still.
Shuffling? How's he doing?
Nope, he's still trying to dig. He's still digging out. He's just like this, just digging out. And I'm kind of coming. I'm just coming at him. I'm going to shoot him.
Okay,
I mean, there's no.
He turned in here and he squared off on you. How did he get there?
He seen me, then he just turned around and just kind of, nope, he wasn't running. He was backing the whole time. Just keep, okay, you know,
so
keeping an eye on me. He's, yeah, kind of. He's keeping an eye on me. He's keeping an eye on me, see where I'm going.
So now he's gotten over to here, and he's still squared off against you?
Pretty close, I think. I just started shooting. Okay, I'm coming at about the same time, too, and about right here, we hit. And he's coming,
okay.
He's coming down just like this.
You first see him, he's there, he squares off on you.
Yeah, kind of,
okay.
Kind of.
Then what happens? With him, just his movement, not yours.
I kind of like that, I was already shooting. And when I heard that noise, it really did scare me. I'm like, boom, boom! Except the door didn't come down. It stayed just like it was open. I actually got close. Boom, boom!
And so what do we know from autopsy? We know that almost every round that entered Mr. Miller's body entered from the left. And when he's describing it, he's describing the right side of Mr. Miller being exposed to him. This is what was described in autopsy as shot number one. It enters from his left ear and travels slightly upward and exits out the right side of his forehead. This one is a different shot where it enters on sort of the left side above his eyebrow and travels nearly straight down and out the right side of his neck. This is gunshot wound three. It enters on the left side of his abdomen, travels up, and exits out the right side of Mr. Miller's chest. Gunshot wound four is the one on the left side, sort of under where his arm is. And gunshot wound five, you can see there, is the one that enters into the left back of Mr. Miller's elbow. So none of these fit at all with with what Thomas Randolph is describing. I mean, even if you take it like in a general sense, he describes shooting straight on, not one of those shots is like that. They're traveling up, they're traveling down, they're traveling sideways for the one into his head. None of those trajectories are even remotely close with what he described to police. Now remember, Mr. Miller was face down for those two headshots, and you can see the blood stain there to show that he was originally in that position. And just think about those two headshots. One of them's from the left ear across, and then one of them is from the top of his left, the left side of his head, almost straight down, coming out his neck. Those are the last two shots that he says he's inflicted, and they're coming at opposite angles on Mr. Miller's body. None of the trajectories make sense. So let's talk a little bit about the law. As you know from Judge Jones reading you the charging document, there's three crimes charged here, two different ones. One of them is conspiracy, and all conspiracy is in terms of an illegal act is it's an agreement to do something unlawful. In this case, it's an agreement that the state is alleging between Mr. Randolph and Mr. Miller to commit the crime of murder. And it's actually just that agreement to commit the crime that's illegal. It's illegal to agree to commit a crime. Now, when it comes to proving conspiracy, you're told in the instructions that basically you can look at facts and circumstances. You know, the law acknowledges that it's pretty rare for someone to have like a videotape or something like that of meetings of co-conspirators discussing the conspiracy. So you can look at other facts and other circumstances in order to determine whether a conspiracy existed amongst two individuals. So what do we have in this case that's evidence of conspiracy? Well, it kind of comes in two forms. The first one is the relationship that Thomas Randolph has with Michael Miller, and the second one is facets of the crime. Now, Thomas Randolph told detectives how it was that he came upon and met Michael Miller.
So you've known him 4 or 5 months. How did you meet him?
At the convenience store, I said, it was a terrible sense, I was getting my car washed. I was just in there just waiting. He was in line before me getting a beer, and it's like he'd been doing, you know, manual labor because he was all dirty and stuff, but there's two or three people in line, and he just kind of joked, and I said, this lady, she's a nasty ID. She does it every time I come here, every day I'm buying a beer, but she always asks me for ID. And something about the day I don't have it or something. Anyway, so I said, well, don't worry, I'll just get it for you. So I just paid for the beer, and I just didn't give it to him, so no, that was yours. I'm getting this one. That's the kind I want or something. But just chit-chatted there, and he took off, and then I got my car down. I was going toward the house, and I seen him along there. Just pulled over and said, hey, you need a ride? You want my way? And sure. So I was there. Just popped in and sat over in front of his house the first day for probably an hour and just talked.
So according to Thomas Randolph, he just happens to meet this total stranger in a convenience store and befriends him and just gives him a ride. And from there on, this relationship ensued. And even though Mr. Miller wasn't really good at doing, as we learned, any kind of handiwork, he keeps employing him and keeps paying him money.
So you engage him to come over to the house then and do some work for you?
I talked about doing some. Excuse me, and he says, okay, I'll help you if you need some help. I got nothing else to do. And I called him and asked him if he really wanted to work. And I said, yeah, he'd come over. And he said he's not good at what he does, but he's a good worker. He works consistently. And it's not like going down and getting a couple of Hispanics on the corner.
So how often does he come over to your house and go to work?
A lot. He's also come over a lot just to watch ball games, and he's ate dinner with us 2 or 3 times.
So he develops this kind of unusual relationship with this handyman that he's just met and doesn't really know anything about. And we learned that starting at about February 12th of 2008, there starts to be phone communication between the two, and most of it is Mr. Randolph calling Mr. Miller, and we know that from Vita Miller, who had like 200 messages from the defendant on her nephew's phone. And you will have in the deliberation room all the hundreds of phone call activities, and you can look at these charts and decide for yourself if they represent a normal relationship between a paying customer and the handyman who works for them that doesn't know how to do anything, or if they're maybe indicative of something else. And look at this in particular, which is in the couple days before the homicide, there's lots of phone activity between the two. And think about why that is possibly occurring, because they're in Utah at that point, the Randolphs are. So why is it that Mr. Randolph needs to call Mr. Miller, the handyman, all those days in Utah? The other thing to take note of course, is the timing of that first call, which is February 12th. Way earlier in the trial, you heard from Liz Labrador, and she told you that it was around that time period, you know, they were having that extramarital relationship that certainly everybody was aware of, but she gives that ultimatum around Valentine's Day of 2008, where she's like, look, you know, you're going to have to make a decision here. It's going to be her or me. And then we see this increase or beginning of phone communications between the defendant and Mr. Miller. Now, we also know from Clifton Miller, he was a really short witness last week, really short in terms of timing, what he tells you. He testified that, he hung out with his cousin. They were kind of the same age. They did some activities together. And he said that Michael Miller was not working as a handyman, and he was aware of that. He was not working as a handyman for Thomas Randolph. He said that was a story Michael Miller was telling his aunt and uncle, but it wasn't true. Now, what's significant about that is that that handyman story, which isn't true according to Clifton Miller, and you have no reason to doubt his version of events, is the same story that Thomas Randolph is telling. So both Michael Miller and Thomas Randolph are telling this same story that Clifton Miller tells you isn't true. And Randolph maintains that handyman story when he talks to the police all three times. We also have the observation of Sharon's family, where they see Mr. Miller and Thomas Randolph constantly together, but no work's getting completed. They observe that Mr. Miller doesn't really seem to have a lot of skills as a handyman, and that they're having secretive conversations. The Millers also have concerns about this relationship. Mrs. Vita Miller testifies like, look, there's numerous phone calls from this guy on my phone. He's spending a lot of time with Thomas Randolph. And Clifton Miller, he describes hearing about this relationship from his cousin, and he says, I advise against it, and I advise him, you're going to get shot. Now, we have other evidence of conspiracy as well, and those are factors or facets of the crime, which you're aware of at this point in the proceedings. You are to believe, according to the defense, that Michael Miller decided to conduct a jewelry heist on May the 8th of 2008. Although he knew the Randolphs would be out of town in the days before, and knew the Randolphs would be out of town on the 9th for several days after, he chooses, for whatever reason, according to the defense, the 8th as the time to commit the jewelry heist. The one time when they're in town over a two-week period. That is evidence or circumstances of a conspiracy, that there was some agreement between Thomas Randolph and Michael Miller to commit harm on Sharon Randolph. You also know that when this alleged break-in of Michael Miller occurred, there was no evidence of forced entry. Now, if Michael Miller was acting on his own, and wanted to cast suspicion away from himself, he would make it look like a forced entry, right? He's been to the house a million times. He would want to make it look like a stranger did it, not himself. If there's stuff stolen on a night when he would potentially have access to the house, he would want to make it look like a stranger, and that wouldn't be him. The other thing you learn from Thomas Randolph is, like, he's the guy, right? Like, he's got all this money. He's got thousands of dollars on him all the time, and that Michael Miller was aware of this, and just maybe that was his motivation for committing this crime in the first place. The question being, of course, if that's true, then how come you weren't the target of Michael Miller when you came through the door?
No, I asked him to go get a 7 or 8 grand out of cash. And Mike's been with me when I've been there. I get the cash and I put it in and send it to Lizzie's mom. I get a check and send it to Lizzie's mom.
So he's been with you then when you've had large amounts of cash?
I've always got large amounts of cash, but yeah, of course he has. And he wanted to go with me to the bank that night and was going to give more money, but Jenna called and said, come on.
And so you never made it to the bank?
Didn't make it to the bank, no.
So he's the guy with all the cash. He would be the one who should be the target of Michael Miller if he were going to commit a robbery homicide. And yet, he's the one that kind of ends up with no injuries whatsoever. We also know that if Michael Miller was in that residence and allegedly was surprised by the Randolphs coming home from dinner early because they were going to have sex, he had other access or other ways to exit the residence, which would not have caused any kind of confrontation between the two, and they would have never known they were there. He could have gone out the back or out the front door as the Randolphs were coming in. The fact that this doesn't occur shows that the object of the conspiracy, what was supposed to happen, did happen. Sharon Randolph got shot by Michael Miller. The other thing is this mask. And Detective O'Kelly actually touched on this yesterday during his testimony. Now, if Michael Miller were actually committing this jewelry heist burglary, he does not need a mask at all, right? Like, he should be taking the property. He's supposed to be, according to the defense, surprised that the Randolphs come home early. So he shouldn't have a mask with him at all. But maybe it's like what Detective O'Kelly touched on yesterday. Maybe it's just a little harder to commit a homicide on someone you know. Maybe if you're going to be lying in wait and waiting for someone in order to shoot them, and they know you and you know them, maybe it's a little easier to have the mask on. This mask certainly wasn't for Michael Miller when he went outside. I mean, he wasn't going to walk around some Las Vegas neighborhood in May with a ski mask on, right? Like, he needed it for inside because of what he was going to do. Randolph also suggests that Michael Miller, knowing that Randolph is always armed and always has a gun on him, that Michael Miller elected to approach him without having a gun drawn.
He just kind of bumped him. He was kind of, I don't know if he was fighting really, but I was just kind of trying to get some space because he kind of surprised me, but I just kind of pushed back. And pulling the gun down because I had it beside me because I was going to look around the corner and see what was going on.
So according to Randolph, even though Michael Miller knows he's always armed, always those guns are loaded, that he decides, look, I'm going to approach him after you shooting Sharon without having a gun drawn. Even more than that, he leaves behind, according to the defense theory of the case, a 38 that he could use on Thomas Randolph were he acting alone. The fact that that gun is left behind is evidence of a conspiracy. Miller did what he was supposed to do with the gun in shooting Sharon Randolph and then leaves it there because that's part of the plan. Another thing to think about is that black bag that the police found. Remember, they find 4 keys in it. They don't know what the 2 kind of high security keys are for, but one of the keys is for the residence itself, and then one of the keys is for the safe in the master bedroom. Like, how did he get that key? Like, they talk about, you know, in the interviews back and forth, well, you know, we gave him a house key, or maybe he picked up a key when the kids were swimming, and, you know, maybe he made a copy. But how on earth did Michael Miller get his hands on a key to a safe if he wasn't cooperating and working with Thomas Randolph? In that June 3rd interview, Randolph even kind of slips, and he knows that he has the keys. The police give him the property report from the impound of evidence at the Randolph residence, And Thomas Randolph reads it, and he's like, oh, yeah, look, you know, he's got two keys. I can see it on the impound report. But the keys aren't identified to the Randolph residence, and they're not identified to the Randolph safe. But he already knows that they're the ones that work, and you can see in the exchange with the detectives that he kind of knows something he shouldn't.
All right, ready to head downstairs?
He had keys to the house.
He did.
It says two keys.
Oh, well, I don't know if those were keys that were his to his aunt and uncle's house. All it says is keys.
All it says is keys, but he knows there's keys, that they're the keys to the house. In addition, the clothing of Michael Miller suggests that this was a pre-planned event. The wearing of the cowboy boots isn't exactly something you would wear if you're about to commit a burglary or a jewelry heist. Michael Miller has been in that house dozens of times, according to the defendant, so his fingerprints would be kind of meaningless in most places. But on this night, something different is going to happen, right? Like, he doesn't want his prints there. Even though they've been there before, on this night, he chooses to wear gloves. Now, we also saw in the crime scene that adjacent to that black bag that had the jewelry and the keys in it, there's some clothing of Michael Miller. There's like a shirt in that one bag. You can see his hat. And then there was a kind of a tennis shoe underneath him, and there's the other tennis shoe bag. So he clearly had other shoes he could have worn if he needed to be kind of surreptitious about it. But ask yourself, who brings a change of clothes to a burglary? What burglar do you know that brings clothing with them? How would that make any sense to a burglary? Michael Miller also had no bicycle left behind. If he were acting alone, that was sort of his means of transportation. There's no unidentified vehicle and no bicycle left behind in the residence. So the counts 2 and 3 are the same charge. One of them is for the murder of Sharon Randolph, and then one of them is for the murder of Michael Miller. What we know about Sharon Randolph and the defendant's relationship is on the day of the murder, the defendant is talking about divorce. Sharon, as we know from her friends, had brought up divorce before. This is a relationship that's very, very, very unstable. Now, during the trial, the defense attached a lot of significance to a particular tattoo that Sharon Randolph had on a private part of her body. I don't think she would be the first person in history that got a tattoo that maybe, you know, didn't age well or maybe they didn't like after a while. But the suggestion that that tattoo is some sort of insight into her psyche as it existed on the 8th, rather than all of her friends saying, hey, she was miserable, this wasn't a relationship that was going well, they were both talking about divorce, is a little bit ridiculous. It tells you nothing about how she felt on May the 8th. We also know that Thomas Randolph facilitated Sharon getting life insurance shortly after they were dating. This is prior to the marriage, and you heard from Liz Labrador that he did the same thing with her, so he was able to facilitate this. You know that Thomas Randolph is the beneficiary of those life insurance policies. And you also know from the testimony that that he believed that he was going to get the house as well, that Sharon had left him the house. And the reason why he believes that is because that first will from 2006 that Sharon signs leaves him the house. Leaves him the house. But she does that other one, right? She does that one with her friend Alice. A year later, and then she leaves everything to Colleen. But no one knows about that will, certainly not Thomas Randolph. And just while we're on the topic of those wills, look at that first will from 2006, because we've been going round and round about the value of this jewelry. It's actually described in that first will, and it says, Sharon describes the jewelry as mostly of sentimental rather than monetary value. So even Sharon Randolph suggests that the jewelry that she has in her possession isn't particularly valuable, except for, of course, and this is important, it has sentimental value. Now, we know also from sort of the other side of the equation on the conspiracy that Billy Miller testified that Mike told him, look, I'm right before the murder, I'm going to be coming into some money. I'm going to become a driver for Thomas Randolph, suggesting that they have some sort of plan together. And Mrs. Vita Miller testified as well that Michael was going to be leaving town and was coming in to some money. Now, in terms of murder, the way the law is you can have criminal liability, meaning you're guilty of murder, in a couple of ways. Those ways are called direct, conspiracy, and aiding and abetting. Now, direct liability is simply you're the one that does the shooting, right? You kill somebody, that's direct liability. Conspiracy means if you make an agreement with someone and the agreement between the two of you is to commit a murder, then you are just as guilty as the person who pulls the trigger. If you have that agreement with the person, you have the same liability. So we know that Michael Miller is the one that shot Sharon Randolph on the 8th. And this is just a portion of the instruction. You'll have the whole thing in your packet. But you can kind of see on that second paragraph, the act of one co-conspirator pursuant to or in furtherance of the common design of the conspiracy is the act of all. So that means if two people conspire to kill someone and one of them ends up pulling the trigger, they both have identical liability. Aiding and abetting is another way to have criminal liability. And of course, the whole instruction is important, but I'm just highlighting one part. A person aids and abets the commission of a crime if he knowingly and with criminal intent aids, promotes, encourages, or instigates the commission of the crime, if you help commit a crime with the intent that the crime be committed. For instance, if you give someone access to a house, if you take them to a shooting range so they get familiar with guns, or if you give them access to a gun, that's aiding and abetting a murder, and you have the same liability as if you committed the murder yourself. This is probably the easiest legal determination. One of the questions you'll be answering as jurors is if a deadly weapon was used in any of the murders, and obviously a firearm's a deadly weapon. Now, Mr. Randolph would have liability for that weapon use, even though for Sharon Randolph, even if he's not the one that held the gun, because if you're in a conspiracy and you know a gun is going to be used, you have the same liability as if you used the gun yourself. Now, Mr. Randolph suggests that, you know, he's not in on this murder at all with Sharon. In fact, he's something of a hero who went through extensive effort to save Sharon Randolph.
I went back down in here to my wife, got back to where I was at, told him everything was cool, got back down here, and shook Sharon again, talked for a minute, and I said, she's still not moving, but she's bleeding really, really bad. And he says, that's why you've got it. She's going to die if you don't do this now. Something about going to be unpleasant. He says, now put down the phone and roll her over and then talk to me. So I remember from CPR and stuff that you got to do the counterweights or whatever. I'm doing the correct chest compressions. And then I kind of thought, maybe I'm not doing these right, I'm kind of doing them like a wild man. So then I started 1,000, 2,000, 3,000.
So he's doing those chest compressions on Sharon Randolph like a wild man. He's really trying to save her life. And this is what she looks like at the scene. She had an injury that caused a lot of bleeding. And this is what he looks like after administering all that aid. Now, you heard from two detectives that, true, there was a small amount of blood on his person, but you can check the Santa Fe video. These are the clothes he's wearing that night, so that means, like, he was wearing those clothes through this whole process. And if they don't have a lot of blood on him for someone doing CPR like a wild man. One more thing with regard to his efforts as to CPR.
And I know when I started to get up, I pushed like that, because I remember it left a blood thing somewhere right here, trying to balance myself to get up.
And I got up, got around Sharon. Excuse me.
So he left a blood thing right there on sort of the frame of the doorway to the bathroom, and it looks like it's like right by the area where the light switch is. Wow, that's the picture from the 8th. It's not there. There's another angle you can see by the light switch. That blood impression that he described from those efforts at saving Sharon Randolph are not present. Then you have the 911 calls, where Thomas Randolph does everything he can to not administer aid to Sharon Randolph. The fire department paramedic instructs him, put her flat on her back. And he says, put her flat on. Should I try to find his gun or something so he don't shoot me if he's not dead? The fire department instructs, hey, let's focus on your wife. Put her flat on your back. I'm going to go to the garage so he can't get in. This is a guy he's just shot in the head twice. Sir, you got to do this quickly. Yes, okay. Put her flat on her back. Oh, gosh, there's blood everywhere. You got to listen to me so we can try to help her. Okay, put her flat on her back. Okay, hang on a minute. Sir, please come back to the phone. Listen to that 911. Over and over again, he's putting any other task in front of administering aid to Sharon Randolph. Now, I sort of circled back on our theories of liability for murder. Obviously, we know that it's Thomas Randolph who shot Michael Miller, and obviously at this point we know that it is Thomas Randolph who betrayed and double-crossed the person he was in the conspiracy to begin with.
I'm a smart motherfucker. I should have been on the dream team. I always wanted to be a lawyer.
So Thomas Randolph is the smartest guy in any room. He's going to talk his way out of this. But, you know, we're kind of at the end of the story for the unreliable narrator, and the people that are going to write the last chapter will be all of you, and the last chapter will be your verdict. And the state respectfully asks you to find him guilty of all counts.
Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a brief recess before we get to the case closing. During this recess, you must not discuss or communicate with anyone, including fellow jurors, in any way regarding the case or its merits, either by voice, phone, email, text, internet, or other means of communication or social media. You must not rewatch this news or media accounts or commentary about the case. You must not do any research, such as consulting dictionaries, using the internet, or using reference tapes. You must not make any investigations, test a theory in case we create an interpretation or any other way investigate or learn about the case on your own. You must not form or express any opinion regarding the case or the files submitted to you. Ladies and gentlemen, it is 1 o'clock. We'll be in recess at 1:15.
All rise for the jury.
You're listening to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph. There's more raw courtroom drama ahead as we bring you unfiltered audio from trial. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a minute. More Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph, next.